Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's Parliamentary Library Lecture, Declining Trust in Politics, What Can Be Done About It? My name is Jonathan Curtis, and I'm the Assistant Secretary of the Research Branch here in the Parliamentary Library. Over the last few years, we've seen increasing discussion of the declining trust in our political institutions, both in Australia and internationally, ranging from the specifics of political parties and politicians down to fundamental issues around the concept of democracy itself. The questions generating a long list of books and articles, all trying to tease out what's causing it and what to do about it. Currently, the Senate Legal and Constitutional Committee is conducting its inquiry into nationhood, national identity and democracy. We thought it's therefore timely to hear from two distinguished Australian academics, Ian McAllister and Patrick Dumont. Their presentation will outline the empirical evidence for declining trust in politics using, among other things, the ANU's Australian Electoral Study surveys that they've been conducting since 1987. Ian McAllister is a distinguished professor of political science at the ANU. From 1997 until 2004, he was director of the ANU's Research School of Social Sciences. Patrick Dumont is professor of political science at the ANU's College of Arts and Social Sciences. His previous university appointments were in Europe and California. Both will speak this morning for about 20 minutes, and then we'll use the remaining 20 minutes for questions and discussions. So it's my great pleasure to welcome Patrick and Ian.
Well, thanks very much for the opportunity to present some of the research from this project. What we'll talk about is basically four topics. I'll give a bit of an introduction to the Australian election study and then talk about views of democracy and possible explanations for declining trust. And then Patrick will talk about voting advice applications and particularly Smart Vote that we ran at the last federal election. And then he'll talk a bit about democratic reform and what we can do about it. So just to sketch in a bit of the background to the Australian Election Study Survey, as was mentioned, we've been running this since 1987. The 2019 survey is the 13th that we've run. It's still in the field at the moment. The results I'm going to show you are a bit preliminary, but they shouldn't change all that much when we get the final data set, perhaps by 1 or 2 percentage points. The survey itself is conducted immediately after each federal election. We typically ask about 250 questions of the respondents, of all manner of things, going back into their voting history, what they thought of the campaign, the leaders, the issues, and a lot of questions about their social background. Typically, we survey about 2,000 respondents. This time round, we've got two innovations. The first one is that we've been running a panel since 2016, so we've actually got about 800 respondents who we've interviewed at both the 2016 and the 2019 election. And the second innovation this time is that we've run a freestanding survey separate from the Australian Election Study, which is part of the Comparative Study of Electoral Systems project. All of the results that we have are all in the public domain, so if you go to our website, australianelectionstudy.org, you can find reports, publications, you can download a copy of the unit record file of the data to analyse it yourself. We also have a report on each election and a report on the trends and opinion over time, and then you can basically do a lot of interactive material as well with the surveys. Now, the very final version of the data, when we get it, will be the basis for two reports, one just on the election and one looking at over time longitudinal trends, and they'll be available on our website towards the end of November. So to look firstly at views of democracy, we've basically got two measures of this. One is a fairly straightforward question that's been used in a lot of surveys based on a 4-point scale about how satisfied people are with how democracy works. When we've asked that in Australia, we've got the lowest point in 2016, second only to the period just after the 1975 dismissal. Now, in 2019, we've got some recovery in this, but it's still one of the lowest figures we find since the early 2000s. And that's the pattern we find. Proportion of people who are satisfied with democracy going back to the late 1960s was round about 3 out of 4. Then we had this very significant decline. And then a gradual increase through to the high point of 2007, then a decline, and then a very low point here again, 2016, and then a partial recovery in 2019. Now, there's another interesting pattern here, which you'll also see when we look at trust in politicians, and that is you can see almost a cyclical pattern here. So there's a high point in 1996, and there's also a high point in 2007, of course. These were major changes in government which followed a long period of the other party being in office. And then after each one of these, you can see that there's a bit of a decline and a bit of a decline. And this almost looks as if there's been a change of government, when in fact there basically hasn't, but maybe a change in personnel. And then we might see that decline again. We'll have to get more survey data to actually analyse that. One of the criticisms that's made of that indicator of satisfaction with democracy is that it's a closed question. So we're asking people to volunteer opinion about the state of democracy, whether or not they might regard that as being something fairly important or not. We can actually do a bit of a triangulation on this using a different methodology and a different survey. And one of the other surveys we run at ANU is called the ANU Poll. It's run 2 to 3 times a year, and it asks what we call an open-ended question about what people think is the most important problem facing Australia today. Typically, the top three issues are economy and jobs, followed by immigration, and then better government. And if you go back to the beginning of the period, 2008-2009, when we were first starting the survey, you can see it was a little more than 3 or 4% of people mentioned better government as something that they were concerned about as a first priority. And then starting in 2010-2011, you can see that round about 10 to 15% of people started mentioning better government as a priority. And indeed, over this period, you can see at certain times, better government has actually been the second most frequently mentioned issue that people were concerned about. So by and large, we sort of believe that there's widespread concern out there within the electorate about the whole operation of democracy in Australia. The other thing we're always interested in doing, particularly in the context of the Comparative Study of Electoral Systems project, is to place Australia within a comparative context. And this is satisfaction with democracy by country. 25 other countries which are part of this big international project that we helped set up in 1996. And you can see, based on the 2019 data, Australia sort of comes up in the top three countries, and the rest of them are mainly Scandinavian countries, stable democracies, high welfare, high taxing countries. Countries at the bottom tend to be quite often post-communist, or countries that have moved out of authoritarianism or have a variety of economic problems. If we go back to the 2016 data, which I mentioned was one of the low points, satisfaction of democracy, Australia was coming here around about the middle of these countries. So we have improved our position, but not as high as we were in 2007, high point. The second indicator we've got is trust in politicians. And again, that's a question that we've been asking quite consistently since we started running the survey. And we've got other surveys which go back to the 1960s, which also ask the same question. And again, what we find is that people are fairly cynical about politicians. But again, 2016 was a low point in the whole process. But even in 2019, we find that more than 2 out of every 3 of the people we interviewed believed that people in government look after themselves. And that's the pattern we find, and again, a very cyclical pattern. People are a bit more optimistic in 1996 and a bit more optimistic in 2007. And then we've got a bit more optimistic views in 2019, and again, you've got quite a significant low point in 2016. So in terms of trying to explain a lot of this, there's a wide variety of explanations out there in the academic literature. Four of them which are particularly pertinent, which we can test using the survey data, are listed here. One is generational change. And you've probably seen quite a bit of literature and publicity over the last couple of years that young people are turning away from democracy. But a lot of this is to do with generations, and particularly millennials. Second explanation is to do with the economy, that the performance of the economy is fairly weak. It's leading to feelings of economic insecurity. People don't believe the government can do very much about it, and that's what's eroding trust. Third explanation is partisanship. People are not as rusted on to political parties as they once were, and that's creating greater volatility in terms of people's voting behaviour. And the fourth explanation that we can look at in some detail is that politicians are the centre of the problem. It's the rise of career politicians who are self-interested and looking after their own re-election rather than the public interest. So we've got a bit of data on each of those. That's a fairly basic test of the generational explanation. And what we've done there is to look at the proportion of people who are satisfied with democracy, disaggregated by age group, for 2007, which, as I mentioned, was the high point of satisfaction with democracy. And then we've done exactly the same for 2019. And you can see along this line here, I mean, there's some changes in satisfaction with democracy, but really there's not all that much there in terms of generational change. In fact, the highest is 91 among this people aged in their early 30s, lowest is 81, so about a 10 percentage point difference between the generations. By contrast, you can see here there's much more generational variation, and indeed if we take the highest point to the lowest point there, it's about a 21% difference in terms of satisfaction with democracy. So there's some evidence that generations may be part of the whole process of declining trust. Interesting thing here is if you do drill into this a bit, which I did using the 2016 data, a lot of these figures here are to do with home ownership and the fact that people aged in their 30s finding it difficult to break into the housing market and difficult to buy assets. Here, a lot of this decline here is to do with changes, particularly in 2016, to do with superannuation and pensions. And that was something that eroded people's sense of satisfaction with democracy. Second explanation is to do with the economy and the idea that the government can have some effect on the national economy. And again, there's a huge literature on this. What we find in Australia is that the effect of the economy and how people vote is not as great as you would find in a lot of other countries, particularly in Europe and the United States. Basically, two reasons for that. One is we have a very short electoral cycle, just 2.5 to 3 years. So people feel that the government really doesn't have a great opportunity to do very much in terms of changing the economy. And the second reason is that people have the view that the Australian economy is really at the mercy of Europe, China, United States, and so on. The government has a relatively small effect on the whole process. And you can see here the idea that people, the government would have a good effect on the economy. Well, there's a bit of a peak here, 1996, and a bit of a peak here in 2013. But in the last two elections, particularly, relatively few people. It was just 14% in 2019. Thought that the government could have a good effect on the economy, and that's a prospect effect on the economy over the future year. Third explanation is to do with partisanship, the idea that people have an emotional attachment to one or other of the major political parties, and as a consequence of that declining attachment, that's leading to much greater voter volatility. Now, we have a lot of data on this going right back to the 1960s. What we find in the data is in 2016, yet again, partisanship was at its lowest point than at any time had been recorded since the 1960s, at least for the major political parties. There was a bit of a recovery in 2019, but still just about 7 out of 10 identified with one or other of the major political parties. And that's the evidence there. You can see the almost a linear decline in partisanship for the Liberal and Labour parties going back to the 60s and then through to the most recent election. Proportion of people who have no identification was round about 1 in 10 at the beginning of the time series. It's now round about 17 or 18% in our most recent survey. Now, that's actually a bit less than you find in Britain, for example, or in the United States, where upwards of 1 in 4 say that they don't have a partisanship. The other interesting part of this, which we've observed over the years, is this line here for the Greens. And when we first started recording this, there was really quite a remarkable churn in the Greens vote. They were turning over maybe 60 or 70% of their supporters from one election to the next. What we've observed in the last three or four federal elections is there's much more loyalty in terms of the Green vote, and that's what's accounting for this relatively high level based on the period of partisanship. The other piece of evidence to do with partisanship is the proportion of people who vote for the same political party in the very first election they would vote in and the very last election before they die. I mean, they're utterly stable over the course of their whole lifetime. If we go back to the late 1960s, it was almost 3 out of 4 people always voted for the same political party. And you can see almost a linear decline here over the period. And over the last two federal elections, it was just 4 out of 10 people. So there's quite significant volatility out there. It doesn't necessarily mean that people are going to vote for a different political party, but it means potentially they might vote for another party maybe once or twice during their voting career rather than the same political party. The other piece of evidence is the proportion of people who say they considered voting for another political party. And again, that peaked in 2016. It was 1 out of 3, and then a bit of a decline here to 31% in 2019. So to try and understand changes in partisanship, one part of this is generational change. There is something going on with younger people. They're much less likely to become involved in electoral politics, to engage in political parties, and they're much more likely to do things like participate in politics through social media and online activism. We also see rising support for minor parties, and as I mentioned, you've got this really quite stable proportion, about 1 in 10 of the electorate who identify with the Greens. And then another thing that we trace in the surveys is people's negative perceptions of political parties, and those are quite marked, particularly among younger people. So the fourth and final thing I'll look at before passing over to Patrick is the role of political leaders and how voters regard political leaders. And as I mentioned, there is a degree of cynicism about political leaders, particularly over the last 4 or 5 elections. We ask a lot of questions about leaders. We ask voters to rate them on a scale, and that's the data you've got here. But we also ask them a lot of questions about traits, and we ask them about personal qualities and things like that. So we can actually track a lot of useful information of how people perceive leaders over time. And the 2019 election, Scott Morrison scored 5.2 on this 0 to 10 thermometer scale. Down here at the bottom, you can see Bill Shorten was on 3.9. We also included Malcolm Turnbull in this because he'd been the previous Prime Minister and so on. That gave us a bit of evidence to try and calibrate some of the results. But if we put this in the context of leaders who've won elections since 1987, the interesting thing we see is if we draw a bit of a line here at 2010... you'll see that the average score for the winners of parties and elections, 4.8. And then if we take this earlier period, the figure is 5.6. Now, there's an interesting methodological question behind all of this, which I've never been able to solve. Is it leaders who are becoming less effective? We're not recruiting better people into leadership positions. Or is it a consequence of voters being more critical and having greater expectations of voters? There's a great academic article in that, if I can figure out how to do the methodology. That's leader evaluations for all the major party leaders from 1987 through to 2019. You can see Bill Shorten really didn't do very well here. He's along with Andrew Peacock right at the bottom. Kevin Rudd in 2007 was the most popular leader in our series. And then you can also see, if you look right down there, when he came back into office, he disappeared to the bottom of the chart. One of the arguments about leaders is that the changes we've seen over the last 6 or 7 years have been something that voters really haven't been very happy with, the constant churn in prime ministers. And again, we've asked questions about this in our surveys. Three of these are from the Australian Election Study, one is from an ANU poll. The very first change, Gillard replacing Rudd, was approved by just a quarter of voters. And then the very most recent one, Morrison replacing Turnbull, it was about the same figure, 26% approved of it. The two in between, people were a bit more divided. On balance, they disapproved, but not as much. And of course, the situation here was that people were not particularly happy with the 2010 Gillard government. And here, of course, Tony Abbott was not very popular as a leader. Now, there is a bit of evidence from the survey that these changes in leadership are really something that voters don't like and affects their view of democracy. And that's the people who approved or disapproved of the most recent change in Prime Minister and looking at the proportion who were satisfied with democracy. People who approved of the change, much more satisfied than people that didn't. And when we do a much more sophisticated analysis, then that's something that does stand up. People who disapproved of it are much less satisfied with the democratic process. The very final thing I'll look at very briefly is in the 2019 survey, we included a battery of items designed to measure populist political opinions. And we've got a lot of comparative data on this as well. There's five items in there to do with essentially anti-elitist attitudes, and you can see this question here, the people, not politicians, should make policy decisions. 50% agreed with that. Politicians, the main problem. 39% agreed with that. They're all highly correlated, and if we put that in the context of the various other countries that we've got data from, which is not as extensive as it will be next year when all these other surveys are complete, you can see that Australia sort of sits in the middle of here. This is on a 0 to 10 scale. We're on about 5.5 mean value. So we're ahead of Austria, Ireland, Germany, but we're behind the United States, Greece, Italy and Hungary. So what we conclude from that is that populist values are out there within the electorate. People believe them, but they've not so far broken into the party system and the electoral system. With that, I'll hand over to Patrick.
Thank you, Ian. For the benefit of the Q&A, I will try to be rather brief. As you could see, of course, the first results from the Australian election study basically contain a wealth of information, and of course, looking at it in a longitudinal way is giving us a lot of information regarding trust in politics and politicians. What I'm going to talk about is Smart Vote, which was a voting advice application that was implemented by the ANU for the latest election. Per se, voting advice applications do not tell us much about trust in politics, but at least these can be considered as innovative tools that provide information on parties, provide information on candidates, and therefore this can be understood as the contribution towards trying to close the gap or at least doing something with regard to falling trust in politics. So that was a research and outreach project on public opinion and political elites with a democratic innovative tool. Now, of course, those voting advice applications are especially used in Europe, and they are used by millions of voters. And actually, the first figures that we've got here from the Australian election study shows that amongst the voters, about 20% of the voters for the latest federal elections used one of the voting advice applications that were provided for the Australian election. So there's a lot of data. This is really big data that presumably in a few months from now will be useful for us to use in synergy with representative surveys, also the candidate survey. So we are really trying to work on that. But what I want to show you today is more the outreach side of things and the democratic innovation side of things of Smart Vote. So the goal was to provide more information on candidates and policy issues, and we ended up creating actually the first ever candidate-based voting advice application in Australia. The other existing one, Vote Compass, looks only at parties and the positions of parties. We wanted to dig a bit further down to the electorate level and to look at candidates. The Joint Standing Group on Electoral Matters in November 2018, there was a recommendation made for the Australian Electoral Commission to provide a leaflet on candidates, their positions also, but also their profile. So we kind of responded to that kind of recommendation ourselves. So with that tool, voters could look for candidates for the House and Senate, or for parties for the Senate that stand closest to them in their responses to 35 questions. If you haven't seen it, it's still there on the website, smartvote.org.au. What we can say about figures, looking just at figures, is that there was a popular interest, and I will show you exactly the number of matchings that were made, and actually in the previous slide you already saw that. But the point was that we thought that a majority of citizens, as Ian showed, consider politicians as self-serving. A number of them also consider politicians as being descriptively distant from the general population with regard to gender, with regard to age, with regard to education, previous profession, for instance. They regard also politicians as not standing for the interests and values of their electorate, and they also tend to consider that politicians would break their electoral promises. What a voting advice application can do with regard to that is at least providing information about how close, actually, objectively, candidates and parties are with regard to the voters. And therefore, those VAAs aim at re-engaging voters by trying at least to switch the political discourse back to policy issues and positions between candidates that stand for parties, rather than leaving it basically to negative campaigning and personal attacks. In addition to providing information on policies, candidates could also present themselves and therefore show how they would stand for their electorate, but also they could give some information about themselves, so therefore trying to address the issue of feeling descriptively distant from the voters. And actually, voters and the media could also give a check on the positions that were adopted by the candidates to see whether or not, once they would get elected, they would still stand for their pre-electoral positions. Of course, that doesn't mean that this is a mandatory position that would need to stay, but at least candidates would be incentivized to be pedagogical enough to try to convince the voters the reason why they had to take different positions once they were elected. In terms of audience and feedback, we had about 500,000 matchings made during the campaign. That doesn't mean that we had 500,000 people using the tool. We had less than that because there was a possibility, of course, of using it several times. But I wanted to show you a message that I received as principal investigator of that project on May the 2nd. That was just a user who sent it to me, so I will just read it briefly. Dear Patrick, thanks so much for developing the wonderful Smart Vote tool, which is always a good start. My youngest daughter, 18 and first-time voter, had recently said to me, "I'm voting Labour because the Liberals are going to blow up the barrier reef." We sat down and went through the small vote questions together. It gave me an opportunity to help her understand some of the tougher questions and for her to reflect on where she sits on the policy issues raised. It was really a great interaction. She feels much better about who she is going to vote for and more informed about the whole political process. Thanks again, kind regards. So that's the kind of feedback that is quite great to receive, and this is actually something that we could not have expected to summarize, let's say, the benefits that could come from such a democratic innovation. Now, the follow-up with regard to research and outreach for Smart Vote in particular. As I said before, we will look for synergies with regard to other data that has been collected by the team at the ANU, and we will be able also to look at research questions on the representative deficit, so how close voters are to the two main parties, for instance, or to whoever got elected. And there are indeed questions about its use in the representative Australian election studies survey. So we will be able at some point in time in the coming weeks to address questions related to trust, interest in politics, etc. Follow-up with regard to outreach. We would like to use the tool between elections. We think that this is an innovative tool that provides information about policy issues, that provides information about policy conflict, let's say. And therefore, we think it would be quite useful to use them between elections to engage younger voters and also reach harder to reach communities who feel less involved in politics. So therefore, we would like to work with schools and associations to try to make it also a tool of civic education. Also, in order to make sure that people, the vast majority of the people, get information and such kind of information about campaigns, we would like also to run voting advice applications, candidate-based as well, for state and local elections, to make, in a way, that kind of tool something that is kind of institutionalized, something that people are waiting for and therefore can reach easily. This is the case, for instance, in Switzerland, where from the local to the national level, you've got voting advice applications at the candidate level that are run, and it's been like this for 15 years now already. Now, democratic innovation like this is just a modest contribution, and of course we are not fool enough to pretend that we are solving anything regarding the falling trust, but at least this is one step that we want to make as academics as well. But democratic innovations, of course, range from instruments like this that provide more information about politics up to much more radical reforms, like, for instance, trying to put aside from an electoral chamber, creating a second electoral chamber that would be made of random citizens selected randomly through sortition. Actually, as we speak in Belgium, there is such an experiment that is being run, and it's more than an experiment. It's the first permanent citizens' assembly that is being set up as we speak. In September, in the German-speaking community in Belgium, the idea being there to complement and to find ways to contribute to that, and at least try to solve this falling trust in politicians by putting the public much more into interaction with politicians and working hand in hand with them. Now, of course, how this came to be, well, it's a bit strange, but the minister president from that region and the speaker of the assembly actually took their phone and called academic experts and asked them to think about the design for something of that kind of assembly. And they wanted to do that before it is too late. These are their genuine words. They were actually thinking that they were losing touch with the population. And to be honest, coming from Belgium myself, this is not probably Belgium being an advanced democracy, probably not the advanced democracy you would think of, where politicians would realize that the gap that is being created is really hard to solve. So that was something kind of unexpected, and we are not really expected either, politicians to take their phone and call us to try to solve and make that kind of radical change. But in general, in terms of cynicism, as Ian mentioned, the question of trust with politicians, there's also the other side of the coin. And the other side of the coin is that, indeed, politicians do not trust their voters either, do not trust the citizens, actually, to take decisions or to work hand-in-hand with them. And we've got some evidence of that coming from different surveys as well. A couple of weeks ago, I was at a conference in Poland. You can see here, for instance, for deliberative forums, comparing the views of the elites and the views of the citizens with regards to whether or not those deliberative forums should oblige decision makers to vote in a certain way. Quite clearly, the majorities are completely different, where you would have citizens that fully trust themselves, actually, to have a greater say in decision-making, while, of course, the elites would take completely the opposite kind of position. In Belgium, even though I mentioned the case of the German-speaking community, there's also quite clearly the same kind of pattern where you would see politicians being quite distrustful of their citizens if they were to create randomly selected assemblies and try to take decisions also either as a complement with an elected assembly or by themselves. Elsewhere, our colleague Caroline Hendricks has been working with a colleague, and together they did interviews with political elites in the United Kingdom, in Australia, in New Zealand, in Canada, and the United States. It's a brand new paper. And actually their conclusion is that political elites value public input, yes, but in one-on-one conversations with constituents rather than in formal consultations or deliberative events. So actually they want to select their own counterparts and to have that kind of interactions. So in a way, political elites consider elections as providing democratic legitimacy for their own position, and therefore they consider that citizens are capable to sort out competent and credible candidates or parties, but at the same time they share a degree of cynicism about people's capacities to co-govern, and we think that is in part due to a lack of information about alternatives and bad experiences with democratic innovations. So there's also quite a bit of information not only directed to voters but also directed to politicians that probably should be done. How should we proceed then? This is the question that a lot of people who want to implement democratic innovations are thinking about. Well, try to talk with politicians and show that actually falling trust and the need to reform may also coincide or correlate with the benefits, at least, in doing their own job and also potentially electorally. So indeed, we can think of examples elsewhere in the world where public input has been sought and actually has provided quite valuable input in times of crisis management. That was the case, for instance, in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, where some deliberative forum was created to use sortition to avoid interest groups capture. That could be also a nice way of addressing that kind of problem, to probe public preferences on hard issues involving values or identity. Think about the Irish case, of course, with regard to abortion and gay marriage, to circumvent legislative gridlock, etc. Also for candidate-based voting advice applications, so going back to the more simple kind of democratic innovations, trying to convince parties of the fact that it's beneficial for them to leave their candidates some leeway, at least, to address pressing issues from their electorate, to recognize also that candidates may be quite different from urban areas with regard to, or compared to rural areas or across different states. Also thinking about votes that can be taken freely, conscience votes. Well, it can be valuable, of course, for voters to know about their preferences in advance. Further democratic innovations, and this is more of a list, and I will end up with that. These are democratic innovations or kind of institutional reforms that have been presented before, that are advocated by a number of observers, academics, and some are also advocated by political parties. Ian mentioned the short cycle for public policy making and implementation here in Australia. Well, thinking about a four-year parliamentary term could be a way to avoid that kind of problem. Reforms of the Senate, there might be indeed some additional electoral reforms to be thought about. The most radical view of this, of course, would be to replace it with a deliberative body of the kind of the German-speaking community, but that's probably a bit too radical at this moment. Term limits for elected politicians are used in a number of other democracies. That could be also a way to address some issues with regard to political supply and the personnel in politics. Recall elections, also widely used internationally, allows voters to write down petitions to recall actually their elected members of parliament and to have a new election during the normal legislative mandate. Reforming parliamentary procedures are certainly things that have been thought about, especially here. The public funding, the donations to parties, and the cap on campaign spending certainly have been high on the agenda right after this present election, because we have been indeed facing a quite specific kind of campaign with regard to campaign spending. And also at the level of parties, we can also think about using party primaries. This is, of course, a shopping list of reforms. A number of them, again, are already backed by some part of the population. There have been some surveys indicating that actually most of them tend to be envisaged positively by the public, but this is certainly also some work for us and the conversation that we need to have with politicians by looking at the international experience with regard to the use of other institutional settings. That will be it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.